On a bitterly cold day, families gather at a cozy theater in the Crossroads. On stage, there's a velvet reading chair with children's books scattered around. It's pretty far from the stereotypical setup for a drag queen.
Sister Glamorama Ding Dong. Are you excited? Can we give her a round of applause?
I wasn't quite ready for that. This is my snow outfit.
Sister Glamorama Ding Dong takes the stage in a fluorescent tie-dyed dress, complete with a giant sparkling necklace. And the story time begins, with books like Jacob's New Dress and 10,000 Dresses.
Together, the girls made two new dresses, which were covered with mirrors of all shapes and sizes. Yes?
My name is Laurel.
Your name is Laurel. Well, her name is Laurel, too. Welcome.
For Henry and his family, the whole experience is personal.
I'm dressed in a velvet dress, turquoise, shoes, and purple tights. Like on special days, like on the weekends, because that's the only day I can wear them.
Yeah, I'm just fortunate that this event is here for the kids to come listen to the stories, and he was really excited to come and to be able to dress however he wanted and get to see some people who are like him.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're going to start today's show finding out more about this drag queen story time. I'd like to welcome Sister Glamorama Ding Dong, who led the festivities on Sunday. Hello.
Hi, good morning.
What was that, your first drag queen story time that we just heard?
It was the first time I've ever read to children dressed like that, yes.
What was it like for you?
It was actually very exciting. My friends own the Pearl Gallery there, so it was like going there was like being with family. And I actually knew quite a few people in the audience and have met their children before. So it was a lot of fun, actually.
Tell me about the stories you picked and why you picked them. I mean, are they stories that you had read before and related to?
I was given a stack of books, and I could choose what I wanted. And so the stories about wearing dresses resonated with me. One of them was about a little boy who wrapped a towel around himself and wore it to school. And that was me as a little boy. I was all about the towels, and his mother makes him a dress. My grandmother taught me to sew. So it was very personal to me. I think that's why I selected them. And I love dresses.
When you see the families who come to this story time, I mean, do you have a sense of how their experience, these children's experience, compares with what you experienced growing up?
I would say that I think more about the fact that we're giving them this fabulous experience with I mean, I'm a sacred clown. I'm big and sparkly and bigger than life, overblown. And
what does sacred clown mean?
Sacred clown means that you can laugh at me. I can give you a hug. We do a lot. The sisters do a lot of charity work. We do a lot of outreach. We do a lot of education. And so
the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence.
Yes, we're the City of Fountain Sisters, and we're part of the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. And we do a lot of outreach. And in the LGBTQ community, we're revered for what we do.
Yeah, can you explain just a little bit more what that means, Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence?
It was started in 1979 in San Francisco, and they really do a lot of outreach. They've been going strong. They were the first people who stood up for the AIDS crisis, and they did it in dresses with veils and rhinestones, and they were part of ACT UP, and they're just sort of rebels in dresses, and we do a lot of education. As I said, we do a lot of community service and helping our community in many ways, whether it's just stand at the door and taking tickets or giving hugs, making people feel comfortable, helping you love yourself and accept yourself as you are.
So where does story time for kids fit into that, like, bigger mission for you?
Oh, my goodness, because you're this bigger-than-life character. You're this overblown image. And for me, it is letting them know that it's okay to be what you are. I mean, at my age, and I'm old, at my age, that you can still have that sense of wonderment and love of dressing up and being sparkly, and it doesn't have to be put in a box until Halloween or on the weekend. You can just be who you are. I've always been who I was, and I think just imparting that individuality, letting people know you can be who you want, it's fine.
I want to bring Wick Thomas in on this. He organized this whole thing. Hi, Wick.
Hi.
So what do these events mean to you, the Drag Queen Story Times?
Yeah, well, I worked at the Kansas City Public Library for a long time, and this is something that I had wanted to do forever. And we've had a lot of help from the library, luckily. But I think for me, this is just such an opportunity for these kids to be able to see adults who are being who they want to be and dressing how they want to dress. And I grew up in a very conservative area, and just having seen that as a child, I think would have made my journey a lot easier.
Tell me more about that. Tell me about what hole might have existed in the journey you did have that you, it sounds like, are trying to fill for other kids.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I grew up in Drexel, Missouri, a very small town about an hour south of here. But I ended up still loving dresses and, you know, still loving makeup and glamour and all of it. But I think that the tumultuous teenage years probably would have been a little easier if I had had role models or examples like Sister Glamour Emma Ding Dong over here.
What were those teenage years like for you?
Pretty rough. We had started a Gay Straight Alliance. I transferred to Paola, Kansas, and we got death threats all the time. Just a very dangerous place to grow up and be out when I was a kid.
How did you deal with that in the absence of role models?
Just did. I mean, luckily at that point, I had been able to find some things like in Kansas City that I would come up to. Like Vibralux, which was a drag band at the time that I came up and saw all the time. So I had started to find my role models at that point, which made it a lot easier to have that support if I didn't have it, you know, at least around me. I felt like I had it in other places.
But as a child, you went ahead and, like, you were saying you lived in a more conservative community, but that you went ahead and wore dresses and things like that?
Oh, yeah. No, that was a very early on thing. I remember, you know, painting my nails when I was, you know, 14 or so, and not understanding why people were making fun of me, because I was like, but they look so good. Like,
So can you take me back to a moment when a role model would have really come in handy for you?
Oh, I mean, probably every day from, you know, 6 to 17. I don't know if I can think of a specific one, because there are so many instances, like, growing up in that kind of area.
You know, the promotional materials for the Drag Queen Story Time say that this is an opportunity for kids to get to know people who defy rigid gender restrictions with glamour, humor, and confidence. And I think that little note, it's not just defying gender restrictions, it's doing it with glamour, humor, and confidence. Can you talk to me about that?
That's pretty much it.
Yeah.
But why is it important to do it with, for example, humor?
Because making people laugh is the easiest way to become friends. Really, I mean, even if we laugh at ourselves constantly, and I think that's the easiest boundary to break, is to make people laugh. If they're laughing at you, they're probably not going to punch you. That's the kind of way I look at it.
And I think it's just, you know, it's ridiculous and it's fun, and kids resonate with that because they love playing dress up and being ridiculous and fun, and so it's a natural fit once you, I think, start to think about it.
There's no restrictions. Yeah. They don't think about restricting themselves and what looks silly. And I mean, we can get up there and giggle and dance and laugh and have a good time, and everybody can do it if you just let yourself, if you just relax and let yourself have fun, let go.
Drag Queen Story Times have been happening around the country, and it looks like the trend kind of started in San Francisco maybe 2 years ago and then moved to New York, and now it's all over the place. Why do you think, like, why now? Why this combination of kids' stories and drag queens right now?
Well, I think, you know, there's a lot of, you know, drag is just being seen more mainstream now. It's more out in the populace. Also, there are more books coming out now. I mean, there didn't used to be very many children's books that dealt with, you know, issues of bullying but they were a little more veiled. And now we've got plenty to choose from, and I think that's a big part of it.
Yeah, I think it's definitely visibility, that there's a lot more visibility in there with social media and that sort of thing, that, 9-year-olds can follow their favorite, you know, a RuPaul's Drag Race performer or somebody that they've seen in an event. And The drag queens I know, the performers I know, understand also, they comprehend age appropriateness. And there's venues now like Hamburger Mary's in Kansas City that children can go and have brunch, and they do drag brunch on Sunday mornings. And it's age appropriate and it's family friendly, and they can go there for their birthdays or for special occasions and things like that. So they're for me, just looking at, you know, I sought out glamour and beauty and things like that from old movies, and was hungry, very, very thirsty for history of what I thought was amazing. But now it's become, again, so mainstream and you sort of visible that you can go and find it where you want it.
You know, in other cities, the drag queen story times seem to mostly be in public libraries. And Wick, you mentioned that you used to work at a public library, that was a dream that you have from back in that role. Talk to me about the choice to go with a private venue, to go with a gallery space.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's something I'd wanted to do forever. I used to serve on the Stonewall Book Awards Committee for the American Library Association. So I'd seen all these books coming out. I had, you know, heard about the drag queen story times happening. But at the library, I worked with teens. I was the teen services librarian. And so
teens don't really do story time.
Yeah. And so, I mean, we found other ways maybe to incorporate some of this. But I, you know, my demographic wasn't children, and so it wasn't really an option for me to do it there. There's a lot of talk. I think the library here is actually going to, I think we might be working with them soon to do some at the libraries as well.
And the library in Lawrence does one.
Yeah, yeah, they do. And April Roy, actually, from the Plaza Library, was super helpful in curating this first drag queen story time. So there's a lot of connections there that we're hoping to continue and grow, yeah.
I mean, in other cities, has there been any pushback against these events?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think they've seen some people who aren't very excited about it. But I think, too, that we miss the concept that, for me, another concept of it that I love is that we're not video games. We're not watching something online. We're real. We're live. We're right there. And we're teaching you to love books. I mean, books are amazing. They're wonderful, wonderful tools. They're great things. They can open your mind and your imagination. So more so than just the fact that I'm in drag and sparkles and reading to them, it hopefully will spark their interest in books.
And there actually have been, in Phoenix, there was a drag queen story time that was canceled after community backlash. I mean, most of these places, if there is any backlash, it's you know, trolls in the comments section afterwards. But there have been instances where the libraries received so much pressure that they couldn't do it.
That's the best part about being in a private venue, is that I mean, they can have backlash, certainly, but it's a private event. You can go or not.
You know, I mean, is that something, though, that is concerning to you or no?
Oh, no. I mean, I've been running, you know, queer events since I was a teenager and, you know, and was receiving death threats at that time. And so, you know, not scared of it now.
I mean, that's quite a statement, though.
What's that?
That you've been receiving death threats since you were a teenager.
Yeah, no, so I'm not worried. And that's, you know, why we're doing this part of it is so these kids won't get those same things.
Ignorance will always lash out. There's no, I mean, it's always part of it. There's the good and the bad. You take it with it. And again, if we can help that, if we can educate in a way, or if we can make those children feel better about what they're going to face, what they may face, what could be there every day, that's even better.
What about just in general, I mean, whether kids are dealing with their own personal questions about gender or not, you know, there are so many parents right now who are making an effort to raise kids with a different kind of gender sensibility, just less restrictive ideas about their own gender and about other people's. You know, how does this kind of storytelling event fit into maybe, I don't know, a larger thing that's going on in our culture right now? And do you have thoughts and feelings about that larger thing?
Yeah, I mean, well, I think this is for everyone, you know, really. I mean, we did, you know, like Henry, who was in the dress, who was having the, you know, best time ever, was a great example. But there were so many kids there from all different, you know, walks of life. And, you know, we had a craft. We had them make paper crowns so they could all be kings and queens. But, you know, we had glitter out for that, which I learned a lot about glitter that day.
A lot of glitter. a lot of there was a glitter shower.
Oh my gosh.
She loved glitter.
And, you know, so it's just, it's kids having fun too. And they get to see these larger than life characters who are glittery and sparkly and hilarious.
I think there was every aspect, though, in that audience of children. There were children who maybe don't feel as if they are a boy or a girl, but it wasn't, there was no question. There were children there that maybe knew other children who are on the gender spectrum, that perhaps they're fluid somehow, and they are their friend no matter what. So there was a lot of that. I mean, you know, Henry was very adamant about that he was wearing that awesome dress, which that was wonderful. but there was, you know, I don't think kids question that as much. And when they do, I think help with our availability to be visible, that parents feel like they have someone they can talk to, or at least a place to turn.
Did you have any interesting conversations with parents on this first installment?
I did. I actually, there were very, the question I got asked most by children, well, it wasn't a question, it was just an observation, that I was a boy. Indeed, I have a beard. Jig is up. I'm a boy. parents were just, they were just happy to see us. And, very thankful. We got a lot of people thanking me for coming and putting on makeup and dressing up and you know, just being accepting.
Now that this Kansas City installment of Drag Queen Storytime is a reality, was there anything, Wick, about seeing it in action that took you by surprise, even after so long of imagining doing this? Just anything about the reality of it that touched you, or?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was just more impactful than I realized it would be for all of us running it. It was just beautiful to see these kids so excited and so happy. And I think something, we're still, you know, working out the timeline and everything. I think something that I realized is that glitter has to be supervised very, very well.
An important lesson for all of us. Well, Wick Thomas, Sister Glamorama Ding Dong, thank you both so much for this conversation.
Yeah, and it's every month. The first Sunday every month.
Yeah, the next one will be at the Pearl Theater on Sunday, March 4th. And up next, KCUR's Central Standard will do a little avian exploration in honor of 100 years of the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, one of the oldest animal protection laws on the books. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now we're going to turn our attention to migratory birds. This is the 100-year anniversary of the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, and National Geographic has teamed up with the Audubon Society and other organizations to call 2018 the Year of the Bird. They're going to be focusing on the beauty of birds, but also how they're doing, because the fate of birds is really closely bound up with the health of our environment and human behavior. We'll be taking a look at the state of birds in our area very shortly. But first, Stephen Wilkes is a photographer and explorer for National Geographic, and he followed migrating birds all over the world for the upcoming March issue of the magazine. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Gina.
Tell me about this project.
Well, it was a really exciting project. I've been working on a series called Day to Night for the last, say, 9 years or so. And the Geographic had given me a grant to do the national parks initially. And it was through that work that I did a photograph in the Serengeti, capturing a watering hole during the peak migration in the Serengeti. And I made a photograph that really, I think, changed my whole direction in this work. The concept is I photograph from a single point of view, and I capture specific moments of the day and the night together. And then what happens is I decide where day begins and night ends, and I create what's called a time vector. And it takes about 4 months of work, but I take the best moments based on time, and they get seamlessly blended into one single photograph. So essentially I'm recreating the day as I remembered it. And this in particular photograph really inspired me because I saw a form of communication that rarely gets talked about. All these animals shared this watering hole and never even grunted at each other. You know, they're competitive species, but suddenly there was this sense that they could share this one resource called water. And that work really made me start to think about animal communication. And I approached the Geographic about exploring this more. And sure enough, they were talking about the Year of the Bird for 2018, celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Migratory Bird Act, and felt that my technique, compressing time within a photograph, might be a really, really exciting way to capture a specific group of species.
And so you went, it seems, all over the world following birds.
I literally did, yeah. We started, the project really began in the Falkland Islands. I went to a very remote island off the Falklands called Steeple Jason, which is, again, you know, very few people have ever set foot on that island. It's controlled by the WCS, you know, and I basically spent 9 days on the island and photographed the extraordinary species called the black-browed albatross, and that's the largest nesting ground in the world for that species. One of the things that's so exciting about this work, I think, and I think hopefully people will begin to experience when they see these photographs in person, is that you, they're much more obviously than just beautiful landscape images. You begin to see the actual communication of the species throughout the photograph, their mating ritual, the way they care for their young, the way they teach their babies to fly. All of that is actually in this photograph.
I've gotten a sneak peek of this piece that you have coming up in the March issue, Epic Migration. And, you know, what stands out to me, well, there are a lot of things that kind of stand out to me, but one of the things that hit me that I don't think I had really thought about before is not just how many birds are migrating together, but how coordinated they are, that they're in these formations that just cannot be accidental. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. I think that was one of the fascinating aspects of seeing how I could describe something. You know, we talk about the concept of emergent behavior, which is certainly an aspect of when you see birds flying, when you see schools of fish underwater. When you see, 40,000 sandhill cranes come at you at sunset, when I was along the Platte River, I was in a bird blind for 36 hours that was elevated, so I had this extraordinary view.
In Nebraska,
In Nebraska, yeah. It's unlike anything you can imagine. And, you know, I've spent my life, I've been very blessed to photograph places and unique experiences all over the world. I've never seen or thought of anything that could have really matched what I was witnessing. In fact, it was so spellbinding visually that I, for about 15 seconds, I couldn't do anything. My mouth dropped, because just imagine this image. I mean, as your peripheral vision, if you look up into the sky, imagine every inch of the sky being covered with these magnificent birds that are, you know, they have 8-foot wingspans, and they are moving in this, like you described, this very harmonious synchronicity. But yet, every so often, they respond. One group will begin to change direction. So essentially, it begins to undulate. The sky literally looks like a huge piece of fabric that's undulating. And it's something that's really magical. I mean, I was never a birder before I started this project, but I've become a birder after doing this work.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, not everyone feels just like scintillated by the idea of watching birds. And I am interested that you're someone who has come to this passion and come to it from a background of work that most people would be like, oh my God, you did what? You got to go where and take pictures? You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. I mean, the places I got to go to from a birder standpoint is like nirvana. You know, being on Bass Rock and off Edinburgh, the coast of Scotland, you know, which, honestly, when you begin to approach it from the water, it begins to sort of look like the island of Dr. Moreau. I've described it because, you know, it is just like otherworldly. You know, you just see hundreds of thousands of birds, it seems like, flying around this place. In fact, it almost looks like there's snow on this huge rock, and you realize they're just bird nests with lots of guano. But when you you know, you when you get into this and you begin to really study these species and see them in a way that I've been able to witness them, one of the things about my work is that it's about a deep study. You know, I stay in one place and photograph literally for 36 hours. And it's not a time lapse by any means. It's me clicking individual moments of everything that I see, everything that I witness in front of my lens.
And you're staying awake all that time, too,
oh, yeah.
Right?
I'm awake the whole time. And trust me when I tell you, there's nobody sleeping on Bass Rock. I mean, it's noisy. And, you know, I had to wear a hard hat, you know, with guano being dropped on me by the buckets. And I'm not exaggerating. It took us 2 days just to clear my cases from the guano. It was unbelievable. And they are a very aggressive species. You know, some of these birds are, for example, like the black-browed albatrosses were just the most genteel. I've decided that if I come back as a bird in my next life, it's going to be a black-browed albatross. Now, the northern gannet, they're just, you know, they don't have the same temperament. So if you get close to their nest, they really try to, you know, and obviously they're protective. And so they sort of begin to attack you. They tend to really like the fat part of your calf muscle. That's their preferred
Whoa.
Strike place. So, yeah. So when you're in the nest, literally, and I was in their nesting area for 36 hours, you know, you become quite intimate with them.
You know, so
let's say it's
in Scotland,
it was quite a challenge. Yeah.
You've been talking about Scotland, and you set up there near the ruins of a church on a hill and had to lug equipment all the way up there. I mean, I've read this in the caption of the photo, but you took. So you've told us you spend, you know, what, 36 hours staying mm-hmm. awake, taking photos. But tell us about where you position yourself, like, in this case. And why? I mean, it does not sound like the comfortable choice.
No, it's the most uncomfortable choice. I think if you talk to generally a lot of photographers, generally the place that almost 95% of the time has the best angle is when you're up against the wall, crouched on the ground. It's never comfortable to get something from a perspective standpoint that really looks different. And this was a similar case. One of the things that really drove my position here was creating, and I wanted you, the viewer of this photograph, to have an intimacy with this species. When I created these images for the Geographic, I was thinking about when you open a magazine and you open up a four-page spread, can you actually see the species and the nuances and the subtleties and the stories that I witnessed within this photograph? So in order to do that, you got to get intimate. And that meant I had to be, you know, really one with them.
So what did you observe? What was the story from your point of view of those 36 hours with these birds, the northern gannets?
Well, it was like watching the World Wrestling Federation. To be honest, I had entertainment. I never saw gannets fight before, but this was just unbelievable. They, you know, it was like watching almost like a Disney cartoon. You couldn't believe it was actually real because they are so territorial. And when, you know, if two females come into a nesting area or, you know, two males, they immediately start fighting. And it's like a death fight. They connect, they literally, their beaks connect to each other in a way that neither one lets go. And so basically, when I say wrestle, they literally are throwing their bodies left and right, like, you know, something out of a, like I said, like a cartoon. And you know, it's funny for a while. Then you start realizing, oh my gosh, they're like hurting other nests. They're potentially, you know, killing other babies. So it's this crazy kind of thing that goes on. And like I said, it's a constant flow because they're all looking for, there's such little amounts of area. You're talking about 75,000 nesting pairs that are actually on this island. Okay. Just to give you an idea of the numbers. And it's a staggering amount of birds that are sharing this one area.
Yeah,
so
why?
They're very territorial.
I know that they don't, like, sit down with their online travel guides and ask themselves, like, where would be a good place for a family of our size? I mean, that's clearly not how migration works, but it does seem like, you know, these are sort of natural patterns and that they would end up in places where they basically fit, but that doesn't sound like it's the case.
No, I mean, one of the things that was, you know, I think birds are really extraordinary for a multitude of reasons. One of the things I discovered through this process was we were in search of, obviously, the first place we wanted to go to photograph flamingos actually was a place called Rio Largatos. We ended up going to Lake Bogoria in Kenya. And the reason we went to Lake Bogoria was because for the first time ever, the flamingos that normally nest in Rio Largatos didn't come in to nest in their normal nesting areas. So I spent 6 months of research and getting permissions from the Mexican government and the national park there to basically, you know, situate myself in a tower to do this picture. And I, 2 weeks before, I basically was told, Stephen, the birds aren't here. And I go, what? They're not here. They haven't come in. We've never seen anything quite like this. So we ended up having to, you know, figure out, well, where can we find flamingos? And we did our research with my editor, Kathy Moran, at the Geographic, and we found a large population that was still in Lake Bogoria. And excuse me. And that's where we ended up photographing. And the strangest thing was when we got to Lake Bogoria, the reason I actually got that picture was because they had excessive spring-like rains in the dead of dry season. And what those rains did, every night at about 9:30, we'd have a massive thunderstorm. And so when we landed there and I got to look at the location, I noticed there was this fresh water run off into the lake. And the lesser flamingos actually, while they love to feed in this very algae-rich and plankton-rich seawater, lake water, they actually love to bathe in fresh water. So I ended up taking advantage, because I knew I had this rainwater, I set my blind up in an area where I knew the flamingos would want to kind of hang out and actually bathe themselves. And that really worked in my advantage. But it was kind of astounding that in both places, the birds were already beginning to adapt to this new climate change, things that were happening. You know, I think one of the things that's amazing about, for me, what I've been left with from the project is that, you know, when you think about like a sandhill crane, I mean, that's a species. They have fossils in Nebraska that are still in existence, you know, they've discovered from 2.5 million years ago. So in a weird way, I'm creating this photograph that captures this moment in time. And in a way, these birds are really timeless. They are, in fact, you know, they go back in time. They represent the present, and I do think they represent the future as well. You know, the old adage of the canary in the coal mine.
Yeah, and, I mean, I wanted,
and what they pretend.
I wanted to get into that with you. I mean, when you talk about the birds not being where they have always been at a certain time, you know, like, can we first address, like, why do birds migrate? I mean, it's not always about where they're going. They're often, like, having to leave a spot that becomes threatening to them.
Exactly. You know, one of the things that was really kind of fascinating, if somebody says to me, Stephen, what was the greatest challenge in creating one of these pictures? I would say actually in Lake Bogoria, where I was photographing in Kenya, the lesser flamingos. And it wasn't a natural phenomenon that was actually my greatest challenge. It wasn't the act that I didn't know whether the birds would come or go. It was actually tourists who would are very, you know, Lake Bogoria has become a very popular tourist place around the world that people come from all over to witness and see these birds. But what they end up coming to do is they love getting photographs of them, you know, flying in the air. And, you know, most tourists are not very patient. So you drive up and you want to see the birds in the air. So they figure, I'll throw a stone, get them spooked, I'll scream at them. And they essentially terrorize these birds. And what happened was where I picked my location, that's where the birds came. You know, my instincts were right. I had the fresh water there. And when the tourists started coming in and seeing where my location was, that was the bird, where the birds were, even though I was well off the main roadway, they started trying to come into my area. And so I ended up having to hire armed guards and we had the National Parks permission to basically block the road and reroute people so that they couldn't effectively, you know, traumatize the birds near my blind.
It sounds like you can also kind of relate to the feeling of threat that the birds experience, just in that you yourself had to hire armed guards to be among them in peace.
I had my producer with me, and I said, we went to the warden of the park, and we said, you know, how would you feel if, you know, I came to your house every morning at 5 a.m., I threw a rock at your window, and I did this for, you know, months on end. He goes, well, I'd probably move. I go, exactly. That's what the birds are going to do. the birds are going to move if we keep allowing this behavior to continue. You know, they're not going to stay here. So I think there was a, you know, somewhat of an enlightening moment. I think, you know, I obviously tourism is so important. But I think, you know, when I tried to explain to people when I would see them on the roadway, I go, hey, if you guys just wait like an hour, you'll see a marabou stork actually attack a lesser flamingo. And when you see that, believe me, you're going to see flamingos fly like you've never seen. It's going to be a lot more incredible looking than anything your rock or your screaming is going to do, you know, so.
But bird migration is just dangerous. I mean, it's really, it's beautiful to see a bunch of birds in the sky, I'm sure, but it's also, it's a treacherous journey for these birds in a lot of ways. I mean, you capture an image of a spotted hyena who caught a flamingo and, you know, that's not tourists. That's just nature can be brutal.
Yes, nature is brutal. I mean, there's, you know, I think one of the things that I found fascinating was, you know how that you talk about when people lose their eyesight, you know, your sound becomes, the way you hear things becomes so more amplified and so much more astute. And one of the things that's interesting when you're in a bird blind is because you're behind this veil of, it's almost like being in a mosquito net. So everything appears cloudy and soft. And you know, you don't, I'd have to cut holes out in order to place my camera and my lens so only that was visible. And so essentially my eyesight was somewhat limited unless I'm looking through my, physically through my camera. But what I started to do was I started to really listen. And as I became more and more aware of a certain cadence, a certain rhythm, like with the lesser known flamingos, I could actually hear when a marabou stork would be attacking. So it was kind of extraordinary. The whole experience was really extraordinary. I hope people get a chance to come to the Nat Geo Museum and see this exhibition, which is opening February 13th.
Well, thank you. Stephen Wilkes, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Stephen's a National Geographic photographer and explorer whose epic migrations photographs will be featured in the March issue of the magazine. When we return, I'll look at the bird activity here at home and what it tells us about our own region. Bird migration is one of those beautiful and bizarre moments in nature. But you don't have to travel across the world to see it. In late January, Kansas Cityans made science happen by writing down what birds they saw while hiking along the Blue River. Through ice and mud and frozen mud, five bird watchers track, record, and observe different types of birds near the bank and in the woods. You've got your Carolina wrens, who don't do well in cold weather. And if you see a lot of them, that usually means there's fresh, unfrozen water in the area. Some of these birds are quiet and really difficult to spot. The group's trying to identify a hawk perched in a faraway tree.
There's some kind of a hawk up here.
It looks like an accipiter, doesn't it?
I think
that's an accipiter.
Yeah.
It's a what?
It's a Cooper's hawk.
Oh.
I think so. There's two hawks that look an awful lot alike. And Cooper's a little bigger, a little buffier. Looks like it works out.
And across the river was a rare treat for bird watchers.
Oh, a bald eagle.
Bald eagle right there on the river.
How about that?
Nice. Adults.
Yeah, so they saw a bald eagle. In the 2 hours they spent walking around, trekking around, the group spotted nearly 1,000 birds, and all the data they collected will be sent off to conservationists to get a better idea of what's happening with Kansas City's wildlife. So I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's what we are going to talk about now, what's going on with birds and what that tells us about our environment here in Kansas City. Kimberly Hess, director of the Lakeside Nature Center, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Mary Nemesek with us from the Burroughs Audubon Society of Greater Kansas City. Good morning.
Good morning.
So tell me, what is the use of the kind of information groups like these collect? When in January, there are tons of like bird census events, backyard bird count type things.
So
any data that's collected gives scientists kind of a snapshot of what's going on with the birds, where their ranges are expanding or not, what kind of pressures the weather is putting on, if crops have failed in a certain area and have pushed birds somewhere else. And in Kansas City, Swope Park actually has some of the earliest bird census data. There was a book written around the early 1900s called Birds of Swope Park. And so census from there, the longer we gather data, the more we can see the changing trends.
Yeah, what are some of the changing trends?
We see a lot of birds come in through our rehab that historically they didn't breed in this area. We've had Mississippi kites coming in, which is a small insectivore, and we've had fledglings that should be much further south in Missouri. So you can see climatic change is affecting where they're breeding and that type of thing.
That they're coming north because it's overall cooler? Or is that...
With the kites, actually, it's probably a little bit warmer. They're more of a southern bird. Mm-hmm. So with them coming up and actually breeding in Kansas City, the city proper now, you can see that trend.
They also like the old growth trees. And so as the neighborhoods mature and the trees get bigger, it gives them the habitat that they're looking for.
Are there any other changes to bird life that, like our previous guest said, canary in the coal mine type stuff? You know what I mean?
I think... a lot of these birds are good environmental indicators. If we have, like you said, changing crops or different tree types, you know, the food sources change and this will give us different types of birds. So, yeah, with these backyard bird counts, it's really important to see these populations and what kind of trends they're following.
Is there an example of a bird where the population size has changed a lot and it tells you something particular?
There's been a lot of conservation success stories about birds that used to be here that we've extirpated, like bald eagles, peregrine falcons, things that we've brought back. It also tells us, like, red-cockaded woodpeckers used to be in southern Missouri. And so the range is starting to expand, and we're hoping that they'll come back and repopulate those areas. And then things are moving in that haven't been here, like painted buntings in southern Missouri. We're getting new species as the habitat changes, as the climate warms, things like that.
So... speaking of the peregrine falcons, that's a project that's been going on for a while, the repopulation, the reintroduction of peregrine falcons. And in Kansas City, it's kind of interesting. I mean, the nests for the peregrine falcons are not in what you would consider like outdoorsy, nature-loving kind of spots. I mean, you've got the Commerce Tower downtown. You've got the American Century Towers on the plaza. Why are those the locations of the peregrine falcon nests?
Well, they provide a couple things. They mimic their historical habitat, which was cliffs along the Missouri River. And, you know, back as the European settlers moved west, we started to suppress fire. It allowed more vegetation. Mammals started predating on them. There was more hunting. And then peregrines hit a real weak spot in the mid-1900s with DDT, same thing that impacted bald eagles. So when you bring them back, those skyscrapers actually do a really good job of mimicking their historical habitat. The other thing is there's a great food source for them downtown. They are a great biological tool against pigeons. And so they're pretty happy. They have housing and food and shelter, and it's a good place to raise a family.
We want to get rid of pigeons?
Yeah, they're not from here. So birds that have been introduced tend to take over from habitat and space from birds that are here, that have been here historically. And so, you know, pigeons are a problem. They're messy and they're not supposed to be around. So anything we can do to control them is a good thing.
And so the peregrine falcons are controlling the pigeons.
Yes, a great biological tool. They are angel of death if you are a pigeon.
But how is it going? That project has been going on for a while now.
Yeah, they first hacked or released a bird back in 1991 from the top of the Commerce Tower. In the past 5 years, they have banded 67 falcon chicks at the three locations in Kansas City, KCP&L, American Century, and the Commerce Tower.
When you say they banded them, what can you explain what that means?
Yeah, so when the chicks hatch and they get to be, I don't know, about in 25 days, they'll band them so we could try to keep track of them, where they show up. And so they'll put a little band or a little bracelet, so to speak, around their leg. And then when they show up in other places, you can read that band and then track it back to where that bird came from.
Why do we want to? I mean, I know that we don't want species to be endangered, but even though the peregrine falcons are still on the endangered species list, there are, 12 active pairs in the state now, right?
I believe that's correct, yeah.
What does that mean to you? I mean, is that... just a sign that people's efforts are working in repopulating them, or has something changed in the environment, in the habitat?
Well, the reintroduction effort's been a big success. So they were gone from the state, and then by bringing them back and releasing them in these areas, we're repopulating the state. And the goal, of course, is to get the state, to get them off the endangered species list for the state of Missouri. But why would you not want to have them? They're an important part of our ecosystem. I mean, people that watch them downtown will talk about it. You can watch on the webcams. It's a great way to connect to nature, and it's also an important part of how the world is put together. And any hole in that fabric is a shame. So,
do you enjoy watching the falcon cams?
I do.
Kimberly, I want to talk to you about owls, because it seems like a lot of neighborhood groups, like the big talk is owls, and specifically owl attacks.
Yes, the infamous Waldo owl. I have talked to a Missouri Department of Conservation. We've discussed this and a few other different neighborhood organizations, like you said.
But like, in case people have not heard about the Waldo owl, can you tell us about it?
There seems to be a barred owl that enjoys swooping down and attacking people. We've looked into it. I've seen some pictures and talked to a few people, and I do believe it is a barred owl from the pictures they showed, and it's a juvenile as of last year, so probably a first-year bird. And to be very honest, I am stumped on this one. There's no natural reason that he would have been attacking people when he was. It was actually, it was non-breeding season. It was not nesting season, anything like that. Because owls will protect their nests. You know what I mean? That's been documented. If you get too close to them, they'll swoop you and things like that. But this guy just randomly attacks people. He did land on one gentleman's head, and has swooped many other people.
Yeah, I have a friend who had an encounter while going out for a morning jog, and yeah, I mean, that's just crazy.
Yeah, it is. It's a little frightening because you can't hear them coming either, since they're silent flyers. So we've thought about it. Like I said, I kind of, is it a food issue? Is it a territory issue? And unfortunately, sometimes we do see well-meaning people will find babies, including owlets. And this past year, we had two owlets come in that people tried to raise. And one of the problems is they can imprint on humans. And that's basically, it's the worst thing you can do to an animal. They're simply confused about who we are and what they are. And possibly, like I said, my best hypothesis is maybe this owl was raised by people, and now it is just simply defending its territory.
The world of people.
Exactly.
Yikes.
So, I mean, like I said, that is simply a guess. I really don't know, since we haven't captured the owl or anything like that. But hopefully he'll grow out of it, is what I'm hoping.
It's just a phase?
Yes.
So, I mean, other than these are sort of, I don't know, bigger stories in a way, you know, like the peregrine falcons being repopulated downtown, and then the owl who attacks people in Waldo. But are there other, as someone who works at the Lakeside Nature Center, where you get calls about rescue animals, injured animals all the time, are there other bird stories going on right now that you think we should know more about?
In general, like the success story with the peregrines is fantastic. Everyone should look this up. It's a great program. And not only, 3 years ago, we rescued a peregrine that was not banded. So we do have these not banded pairs coming in and, you know, breeding in that too, because this was a juvenile.
So that means that they were not like planted, basically.
Exactly. They weren't put there on purpose. They're coming back. And that's, like I said, that's a complete success story. Along with that, bald eagles, you mentioned them earlier. Missouri actually has more bald eagles than any of the lower 48. So it is a great place for families to watch for them. We have eagle days at many different parks. So it's just wonderful that we're in a state that really takes to heart this preservation and works very hard at it.
When you were saying before that people make the mistake, you know, that when an animal imprints on you, that's the worst thing that could happen to it. You know, as someone who works with rescue animals, I'm curious how you care for them without letting them imprint on you.
unfortunately, it is sometimes very hard, but we take very good great care not to do it.
Like how?
Instead of imprinting, you socialize them. I'm actually working with a bald eagle right now that I will go in and I will sit with her, just simply letting her get used to me. She's a non-releasable bird. And from there, we start with food. Everybody loves food, including birds. And I start by hand feeding and like I said, general socialization.
But how does that bald eagle not imprint?
She's old enough.
Oh,
one
okay.
of the thing is if they're old enough, it works much better.
So you have to just, how do you care for young birds?
Well, we actually use hoods and masks and things and keep our faces hidden when we're feeding and doing all the parental care. Yeah.
So that they think you're a big bird?
Pretty much, yes. It looks pretty silly, but it works very well.
No, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, our time is up. Kimberly Hess of the Lakeside Nature Center, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Mary Nemesek, Vice President of the Burroughs Audubon Society of Greater Kansas City. This has been great. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's a wrap. You can listen back to this morning's conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, an exhibit of the masks that inspired Picasso raises questions about where we draw the line between inspiration and appropriation in art. Tune in for that discussion tomorrow at 10. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with lots of help from intern Matt Groby. I'm Gina Kaufman. You can talk to us on Twitter. We are at KCURCST, and Up to Date is next, so stay listening to KCUR. Thank you.